Hi, and welcome to Let's Talk Safety. I'm your host, Dylan Sutherland from Protector Safety Gear. Throughout this series, we'll be interviewing industry experts to provide our audience with valuable insights on various categories of PPE. Topics will range from selection and standards to maintenance and care. This should ultimately assist you in selecting fit-for-purpose safety solutions for your site. From these discussions, we will create resources such as Toolbox Talk downloads and blogs, all of which will be available on our website, www.protector.co.za, for download. In today's episode of Let's Talk Safety, we're going to approach the episode a bit differently. Usually we're talking about standards and PPE that keeps people protected. But there is an element to safety where safety is generally seen as a numbers game. We measure safety by LTIs, we measure safety by incidents, we measure safety by near misses. Today, I'm joined by somebody whose story represents one of those numbers. I was fortunate enough to experience Partington Tatabikwa through a safety conference earlier this year. When he spoke with a lot of honesty, humility, and vulnerability about his experience and his story. When I was experiencing that, the first thing that popped into mind was, this is why we do it. As a Protector Safety Gear, we are ultimately trying to keep people safe, trying to keep them protected. And as Partington spoke, the image of us trying to educate, us trying to make sure people realize the seriousness linked to safety really hit home. After that, I reached out to Partington, and Partington humbly accepted our invite, and he's agreed to share his story. So hi there, Partington. How are you?
I'm fine, Dylan. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking time and spending time with us.
And thank you for inviting me here.
No problem. Partington, I think your story is deep, is real. A lot of elements in your story really inspires a thought of, if we can share this story, which must be really difficult for you, even if it can keep one more person safe, make sure one person doesn't get injured, hurt, disabled, this is a big factor that could help safety in general. Something I'm quite passionate about at the moment is when we talk about the stats of safety, FEM has all of their stats, and the stats that are recorded, in 2024, there were 6,000 incidents recorded. Of that, about 60 people were fatal. That equals, and it's not to downplay the seriousness, it equals to 0.1% of the incidents were fatals. Yet, this is generally where we focus. I think to dive in today is the stat that I believe is generally a hidden stat, which is permanent disabilities. It's got a much longer lasting effect. It generally happens to the breadwinner. And I think understanding your story and understanding how it's affected you and what you went through can actually hopefully protect people in the future. So thank you for today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dylan. Yes, I do agree with you. Disability is normally, according to people's perception, you know, something that they just take for granted. But it's not easy, because you have to start life all over again. And it's not an easy thing at all. You have to, you know, learn how to sit, how to stand, how to walk. And above all, you have to reconfigure yourself and reinvent yourself and see what else you can do. Because what you used to do to feed your family, you can't do it anymore. It's not easy. I do agree with you.
That must be a harrowing experience. And I mean, to see you come out on the other side, and I believe you're on a successful journey. I think that's going to be inspiring to people as one element of, if you do get knocked down, you can build it up again. But let's share your story, because I've still got goosebumps, and I remember hearing it the first time gave me goosebumps. So I hope our audience gets the same understanding. Do you want to share with us what happened the day of your accident?
Oh yes, Dylan. It was on the 4th of June in 2010. It was a very cold morning. And I went to work as usual, thinking I would go back home safe. When I say home, I mean at the mine. But my family was staying in Johannesburg. And it was just a week, exactly a week before the start of the World Cup. So I was thinking, after finishing my job, then the following day, I would actually go to Johannesburg, where my family stayed, and see my family. But it never happened this way. So on the 4th of June, as I got to work, an explosion occurred at my place of work. And I got burned. I got so burned that I had third-degree burns on over 60% of my body. So I was then airlifted to a hospital in Kimberley. I stayed there for some time and my condition worsened. Then I had to be transferred to another hospital in Johannesburg. When I got there, the doctor there actually said my chances of survival were 50-50. So I was sedated for 8 months. When I woke up after the 8 months, I discovered I had lost my limbs. I no longer had an arm. I no longer had a leg. And imagine the stress, because as an artisan, I was using my hands and my legs to make a living, to feed my family. I got so stressed. How am I going to do it? How am I going to walk again? How am I going to do all the things I used to do? But fortunately, when I was sent to the rehab, because remember, at the rehab, that's where they train you how to do the things you used to do, by giving you exercises and so forth. So I recovered at the rehab, and I stayed there for another 4 months, which makes the total time I was in hospital 12 months. Then when I got out of hospital, I had to think, I had to reinvent myself. That is when I started doing health and safety, because I saw that it was purposeful in my life and I'm passionate about it. In short, I can say this is what happened.
Sure. That's quite a harrowing story. I mean, would you be willing to share with us that day's events? How did it play out? Was it we interested in keeping people safe and allowing, I mean, did you have the appropriate safety at your disposal? Was the job rushed? I mean, where did this go wrong? Where did that day go wrong?
Actually, I'll speak from a position of, you know, the theory of multi-causation. There were so many causes of this accident. Some of the things I could prevent them, or I could have prevented them. But the other things, they were also management related. For example, there was pressure for me to finish this job. Then on my side, we used the wrong equipment. Instead of using scaffolding for the job, we used a barrel instead for the job, which was not correct. And then also, on my side, we did not do proper risk assessment to check what the barrel used to contain. So we did not know it contained something that was flammable. Then also, if you look at the disposal of these barrels, which was a culture that the company had actually adopted, the disposal was not correct, which means the company had no waste management philosophy. So that's the other thing. Then also perception issues, risk perception. On my side, I think, you know, risk perception is normally affected by several factors. For example, it was a very cold morning and it could have affected my risk perception. Just being feeling cold, because you are numb and, you know, you're not thinking straight. Then also my risk perception could have been affected by fatigue, because I was one person who loved overtime. I would work overtime, you know, until the cows came home. So I think also fatigue played an issue. It affected my risk perception. I can talk about awareness training. Okay, we had been trained in the company, but you know, training is something that should be continual. It should be done always so that you remain aware and you remain in the moment. So I can say those are some of the factors that led to the accident.
So I think something that stood out the first time I heard you, and I can hear it again, is you've got a high level, I assume you've got a high level of accountability. You like to take on what was I responsible for. And you mentioned the risk assessment. You were responsible for the risk assessment. But I don't necessarily, I mean, in my mind, there's a cause, there's something that happens, but there's generally a background to why it happened. Now, am I right that this job was rushed, which could also exclude the need or remove the need for or the importance of doing a risk assessment? Because being told you need to get this done, I mean, your priority is to get it done, right? Not to do the risk assessment. Did that play a factor in it?
Yes, it did play a factor, because I remember this job used to take us about 3 to 4 days, but then we're told to do it in a day.
Sure.
So starting from the permit to work system, there was a permit to work system in the company. Was this company had all the systems, procedures, policies in place. But we never followed it because we wanted to finish the job. So remember also, a permit to work system is a form of risk assessment. Then comes to the informal risk assessment that one should do always before you start a job. We're supposed to do it. But because of that pressure at the back of our minds, because it was me and my colleague, we did not do the risk assessment. So I can say it did play a factor. But also, you know, as a person who loves to take accountability for my actions, I would say, despite the pressure, I think we should have done the risk assessment, especially the informal one, just to ensure our safety. Because if you take safety as a value, you should be able to see, I need to do a risk assessment.
Of course.
Yes.
Tommy, I'm curious. How did you see work before the incident? How did you, I mean, you just said you loved overtime. I can assume why. I know that you loved overtime. But your job itself, how did you see your job before your accident?
I loved my job. I was actually very good at it. This on-site line boring that I was doing in the mine, I was the only one who could do it. Not to say nobody else would do it after training. They could do it, but I think for me, it was the passion. I had so much passion for my job. I actually was telling myself that at a certain age, I would actually start my own line boring company or my own engineering company. That's how passionate I was about the job.
Sure. And again, before your accident, did you at any moment think this could have been the outcome where you are today?
No, I never thought it would happen to me. I used to see it happen to others. I remember at one of the companies I worked for, there was a guy whose hand had been amputated by the shoulder. I used to see him and I used to think that was him. Maybe he was careless or maybe he was unfortunate, but it would never happen to me. That was the attitude that I had.
Let's then talk about the actual accident. So, like you said, I mean, there were certain things that were possibly in your control, possibly in the business control. In a perfect world, what would have avoided that accident? Just the headliners. And I know there were a lot of factors that created the accident. But if you have to look back and think, if this was changed or this was changed, what do you think those factors are?
I think I'll divide these factors into two, just to shorten the conversation. I would say from the management side, there could have been clearer leadership, that's visible leadership. Some call it visible felt leadership.
Yeah.
I think that was very important. And also from the management side, I think the way they took their priorities, it looks like they prioritized production over safety, which I think is not correct. I think it's better to prioritize safety over production. It's more sustainable.
Yep.
Yes. Because remember, if you prioritize production, for how long are you going to do it without encountering an incident? It's very difficult.
100%.
You can't do it for a long time. There's something that will happen. But if you prioritize safety, your chances of moving on without an incident that is going to stop your production, they are more.
Yep.
Yes, that's from the management side. And also, from my side, I would say I should have taken greater ownership of safety. To me, I used to take safety as common sense. But you didn't need to think to be safe.
Yeah.
That's how I took it. Yet safety is not common sense.
No.
Yes, you need to contemplate. You need to think before you act. And it's not common sense because, remember, there are procedures and policies and whatever to follow because they've been proven to work. And a lot of other things, it's not common sense. So my attitude towards safety could have been better than the attitude I had at that time. I think it could have been avoided.
Okay.
Yes.
If we look into the points that you've mentioned, you're spot on. I mean, VFL or visible felt leadership is a big conversation at the moment. In your mind, what would that visible felt leadership have looked like? What would have been an ideal situation?
Yes, I think just supervision. We did not have adequate supervision. You know, if, for example, there had been adequate supervision, they could have seen that we did not even do a permit to work before the job. Things like that. If the manager was there, he would have seen, oh, there's no permit to work system here, and already there's a problem. Oh, they are using the wrong tools for the wrong job. It could have happened if he was around, but the fact that he wasn't around, I think it contributed to all those disasters.
And I think linking that to your second point of basically profit over people, when a business decides that it's more important to make money than protect a person, it's quite easy to turn a blind eye to whether a permit to work has actually been implemented.
Exactly, exactly. Because then you're focusing on just making money.
Production.
And yes. Because normally it's always wise to actually focus on safety and production, but then you should prioritize safety, put safety first.
Yeah.
Then you talk about production. And in a way that, you know, emphasizes the importance of safety.
Yeah.
I think that way an accident can be averted.
When you talk about your side of it, of common sense, I mean, one of the smartest people I know uses the phrase, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that hits me hard because it's the older, the more experience you get, the more you start learning something, the more you realize how little you actually know about that topic. And I mean, it's the same in safety. There's so many different elements linked to safety that if the safety component of the business is done properly, they should be able to educate you with what might affect you and what might end up affecting you for the rest of your life, right?
Yes. Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Partington, tell me, when the accident happened, what went through your mind? I mean, the moment that this had happened.
When it happened, like during the incident, of course, the first thing I thought was, oh, somebody's planted a bomb for me. I also thought, someone has bewitched me, and so forth.
Yeah.
But then when I was sent to hospital the same day, I started thinking about my family and my future.
Yeah.
It's how they were going to make it through. I was just seeing disaster. Because I was actually doubting if I would make it in life. So, yes, that's what went through my mind.
And linked to the actual accident, was it an instance where whatever was in the barrel caused a reaction that created an explosion? Was that actually what the accident was?
Yes, definitely. Because the barrel had a flammable substance.
Okay.
The substance was not only flammable, but it was also having a low flash point of about 40 degrees. But I only knew these things later.
Yeah.
Yes, and then the substance was also volatile. So, which means it evaporates easily. So then there was an ignition source to that substance, to the vapor. And that's what caused the accident.
Sure.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, the next part of it is exactly what you were saying just before this. I mean, there must have been difficulties you faced from a physical point, from a emotional point, from a mental point. What was the biggest struggle once you had come to grips with what had happened? And what was the most difficult thing to handle? Was it the physical, mental, or emotional?
Everything. I cannot even say this one was more difficult. I can say for the physical, it was the pain.
Yeah.
Just the pain. It was excruciating. You know, burns are something that are very painful. So it was the pain. And then later on, of course, when they had amputated me, you know, the idea of trying to get mobility, it was very, very difficult. And then from the emotional side, obviously, you know, I was shattered inside because I was thinking I would never make it again. I never thought I would walk again. I never thought so. So it was eating me all the way. And also the fact that I'm looking at my family and saying, who's going to feed them? No, all those things, no, they were just, you know, shattering inside of me. Then my mental state, you can obviously tell, because the three are linked and you can't separate them. So I can say everything was just bad.
And, I mean, the obvious, because, and that's why I'm asking, because I think for us, the obvious change is you lost a hand, you lost a leg.
Yes.
It's quite important for people to understand that there's a much bigger end result than losing, and I say just losing your hand or just losing your leg. It's not just losing it, it's a big thing.
No, it's a big thing.
But the fact that, like you say, the emotional and mental side of it, that people need to understand is linked directly to it, and you don't necessarily see that.
You don't see that, and normally people like us, people like me, we suffer in silence. We don't say most of the things that we go through in life. And people don't understand it because it's like now we are living in different worlds. The only thing I'm very appreciative about is that at least I know the other side. Now I'm this side, I also know the other side. So I know how people think. We suffer in silence. And it takes a lot of understanding and education and awareness for people to really know what we go through. So it's not as simple like you're saying.
No, really. The visual is a lot different to the reality.
Yes.
From a practical sense, I mean, and I know it might seem silly, but I like to make things real. How does having lost your leg and lost your hand, how does it affect you? I mean, what does that look like in a day-to-day basis?
Well, I can say I struggle with everything. Although I'm now used, no experience also helps. But there are times that I have lapses and then I end up on the ground, I just fall. Maybe I forget to lock my leg or I just slip and fall, you know. So it's a struggle. It's a daily struggle. Then also, I live with pain all the days of my life. There's no day I can say will pass without pain. Because when you wear the prosthetics, the prosthetics are just like the PPE.
Yeah.
They are not all that comfortable. No, they're not. So when you wear it, it might feel comfortable. After a while, you start feeling pain, you start feeling itchy inside. You know, it's just a disaster. But now we have to persevere. Because remember, I don't live for myself. I live for other people. I live for my kids. I live for my family. I live for friends. So I have to soldier on. There's no other option. I won't give up.
That's a good mindset to have. And it's quite spectacular that you do have it after having gone through the challenges and the struggles that you've obviously been through.
Thank you.
What helped you, though? What helped you get to that point? What helped you through those difficult moments? What was that?
So there are a lot of things. When I was at the rehab, I started comparing myself with people that were worse off than me. I remember one guy who came into the rehab. We had two legs and two hands. But his two legs and two hands did not function because he was a quadriplegic. He had been shot in the spine. But the guy was so happy. He used to say jokes and people would laugh in the orthotist's room. So when I saw that guy and compared him with me, even though I have one leg and one hand, the fact that I can do a lot of things, I started having an attitude of gratitude. So just by having that, it helped me to improve. I started accepting my situation and actually thanking God that I was at least he had given me a second chance. But then when I went out of hospital, I love reading. So I read a certain book. And this book, it talked about a guy called Mr. Nada Ashi. Maybe he can also assist some people. So there were the contacts of Dr. Nada Ashi. Then I said, man, let me just contact this guy. Maybe he can help me with my situation. I contacted him. I told him my story. And he said, no, I'm willing to help you through. So the way I'm going to help you is to send you another book. It's called Always Rich. So he sent me that book. Then I read that book. The things in that book are very transformative. They actually transformed my way of thinking. Yeah. Then I started developing this positive mindset. Then I started reading other books that Dr. Nada Ashi had actually referenced in his own book.
Yeah.
You know, people like Dr. Wayne Dyer, people like Napoleon Hill, and so forth. So those books, you know, started, you know, changing my mindset. I started realizing that I am more than what I think.
Yeah.
I am not my hand. I am not my leg. I am more than my hand and my leg. And I'm not my work. I started realizing that. And by realizing that there's an inner person within me, my life started to change. Hence this positive attitude.
That's phenomenal. It's amazing what knowledge sits in the pages of a book. I mean,
there's a lot of knowledge. I think it's because when a person writes a book, most of the time they are in spirit. A person won't just write a book for the sake of money. Normally, they apply their mind and they are also in spirit. So that's why you see books normally are very transformative.
Yeah.
Yes. So it really helped me a lot.
Fantastic. Tell me, I hope that the audience is, generally we try to talk to either one of two people.
Mm-hmm.
The person using safety, who, like you say, there's a responsibility linked to that person, as well as the person selecting safety and making sure that the appropriate safety is provided for the appropriate job. If there is a listener that's listening to your message, What message of safety would you give that person?
I think the most important thing is for one to take ownership of safety. Just to remember that safety is not for the other person. Safety is not for the manager or the supervisor. Safety is for you and your family and your loved ones. It safeguards you to actually enjoy those things you love doing most. Like me, you see, now I can't enjoy most of the things I used to love doing, like playing soccer, swimming, and all that. Safety is for you. That's a message. And also, at the workplace, it's important to follow the set procedures, the procedures, to follow the policies, to actually listen to our supervisors, to report incidents, anything related to safety. You must take it seriously and avoid, taking safety as common sense. Yeah, like I mentioned earlier. And also to be in the moment all the time. That's very, very important. For whatever you're doing, whether at work or you're at home, be in the moment. I know there are a lot of things that are very destructive. When I say destructive, not destructive as in to destroy, but that distract our attention.
Yeah.
For example, you see a person walking with hands in their ears. That's very destructive. You are no longer in the moment. You have to be in the moment all the time and just take safety seriously. Being in the ICU, like what I did, is not easy. And coming out of it alive is grace and nothing more. Always do a risk assessment. I always talk about risk assessment.
There's something that you hit on that's really important, that there might be a bit of value for us to just dig into, but is when you're talking about reporting, why did you mention specifically reporting and reporting incidents? What's your perception of how that works in South Africa? And also after that, what's your perception of what it should do if it gets done properly?
Yeah, I think I talked about reporting incidents because when we use the barrel that we used, it wasn't the first time for us to use that barrel. It wasn't. But we knew the correct equipment that we should have used, like the scaffolding. And then I can say there was no scaffolding at the site on that particular day of the incident. If we had reported that there was no scaffolding, it would have made a difference. Because on that day, what made us use the barrel was the fact that there was no scaffolding at the site. So reporting incident helps generally in that the moment you report an incident, measures can be taken to avert an accident or to avoid an accident. But if you don't report and you just keep quiet, it becomes a habit that you do the wrong thing and then one day it will catch up with you.
There is, and 100% agree, but there is an element that when you are expected to report, it could also be seen that you might be complaining or you might be just trying to be a nuisance, maybe. And I think maybe there is an element where some people think if I report it, I might get into trouble. I might get into some sort of disciplinary because I'm getting somebody into trouble or I'm highlighting. Do you think that's an element when it comes to reporting that?
Yes, it really, yes, that's a culture problem.
Yes.
According to me. If leadership can actually encourage people to report and they prove to the people that when a person reports, they don't reprimand the person Instead, they each actually praise the person or give an incentive to the person. They reinforce the good behavior of that worker we as reported. I think it helps a lot.
And possibly not even, I agree that praise could work, incentive could, but even actioning. When you report something and there's a reaction and you didn't have scaffolding, you reported it, a week later you saw their scaffolding, it probably also creates a positive mindset for you that
exactly
when I bring a problem up, where and when it can be done, it gets handled, right?
Exactly, exactly. That's very true. Actioning is very important. When you see the results, then it also helps. So it will be building a culture. At the end of the day, you don't need to reprimand it or even talk about reporting. It gets embedded in the hearts and the minds of the workers because they know that's the right thing. It becomes a culture. So I do agree with you.
And I think the reason I'm bringing that is that sits with the leader, the leadership.
Yes.
The person that is responsible, it could be the safety officer, it could be the safety manager. It's quite critical for them to actually look into any reports that get done.
Yes.
There might be some that aren't too serious and the person might perceive it more serious than what it is and walk the person through that, right?
Yes, yes.
Not just dismiss it and not talk about it because that creates this thing of whenever I talk, nobody listens.
Yes, that's true.
I think that leads into the next point that I have, which is why do you think people take shortcuts?
So what happens is you take a shortcut the first time, you find your job goes very fast.
Yes.
Yes. So next time you do a shortcut, your job gets very fast. So by taking shortcut the second time, you have reinforced their behavior. So you end up thinking this is the right thing to do. Because it's helping you to do your job faster.
Yeah.
So that's why people take shortcuts most of the time. So it becomes a habit.
And that would help you convince yourself that the procedure is wrong. The procedure takes too long.
Yes.
My shortcut works better, even though it avoids safety.
Yes. My shortcut works better. And because you never got injured when you took the shortcut, you think nothing will ever happen.
Yep.
Yes, what you don't know is one day is one day. You're doing the wrong. Yes, shortcuts are not good.
And linked to that, do you think there's also a connection with avoiding using PPE? I think you mentioned the comfort of PPE. Do you think that makes people avoid using PPE?
Yes, I think people avoid using PPE sometimes, especially the fact that it's uncomfortable. I used to work at a company where we used to wear some hard hats, and the climate in that area was so hot. Then you'd sweat through that that helmet. Obviously, you want to avoid using the helmet, but you're not considering that the helmet is actually protecting you if something falls and stuff like that. Yeah, so people do avoid using PPE. It's not, generally, it's not comfortable. But remember also, PPE should be used as a last resort. We should use PPE, but as a last resort. But I'm not downplaying the importance of PPE. PPE is very important. Even when everything is in place, like they say in safety, or like we say in safety, but PPE is very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, spot on. So the hierarchy of controls keeps PPE right at the end.
Yes.
Try and eliminate the risk as far as possible. Aside from comfort, I mean, I think you've got a vast amount of experience in sites or on sites, actually having to use it. Apart from comfort, is there any other reason that PPE gets disregarded in your mind?
I think most of these problems of disregarding PPE would be culture related. Yeah, if the organization has created a culture of not wanting the PPE, I think that can cause people to just neglect it. And but I'm very happy nowadays because of, you know, these AI things that are in place. You get situations where a company has got maybe a, what do you call that, 10 some sensors that can actually see that this guy is not wearing PPE, and it will, you won't go in if you're not wearing the proper PPE. But when you're inside, it can also become a problem, because he goes in, when he's inside, he takes it off. And that, but it also needs that visible leadership we're talking about. The supervisor is to see, oh, there's someone, man, who is stubborn. And the other people should be able to report as well. That, you know, there's a particular individual who's not putting on his PPE all the time. Yeah. Then if it becomes a culture that everybody knows the importance of PPE, I don't think we can experience a problem.
I think it's extremely difficult to get to that from a point of exactly what you said. I mean, going through the turnstile, it's easy to put the safety on. The moment you get through, if you don't truly believe that something could happen to you, you probably don't take that safety seriously.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, that's true. I mean, we go back to the point of, have you internalized safety? If you have internalized it, and if maybe you have also seen someone like me and how I battle with things, maybe it can also change your mindset.
And being clear that's why I asked the question, in your mind, this could never happen to you.
Yes, that's what I thought. I always thought it would never happen to me. But here I am.
Yep.
It happens to everybody.
The one challenge, and I'm not an admin person. I'm not good at admin. I understand the function it plays in safety if it's done correctly and if it's practical. I observe safety generally from an admin point as a tick box exercise. Either one, just saying we've got the right documents in place and the right procedures. Two, keeping the people that are actually responsible, the one should be on the ground, visible fault leadership, people actually required to keep people safe, keeps them inundated with documentation of safety. Do you believe that's a problem that gets faced?
I think that's also a problem if it becomes too bureaucratic. Yes, and also if you've got these heaps of, you know, files, and it also becomes a problem. I think we need to keep it simple. We need to keep it shorter.
Yep.
So that, you know, people are encouraged to do it all the time. That's also very, very important. I've seen many organizations with so much heaps and heaps and heaps of paperwork.
And practical, right? If it's practical, people are more likely to engage.
Exactly. If it's more practical, people are more likely to engage. I will not mention the company, but I worked at a company that had what they call Invocoms, that's involvement and communication sessions every morning, where everybody is involved. Everybody is involved in the production. They were doing it, or we were doing it departmentally. So everyone is involved with production. You know the reliability and the whatever of production. Then you talk about it. But safety was always on number one. Talk about safety incidents, talk about this, talk about that. Everybody gets involved. I think that's more practical. Then you have literal paperwork. The bad thing is to have heaps and heaps. It's also discouraging. I think a balance has to be struck as to the admin and also the practical side of safety.
Yeah, and it's a dangerous kind of space to be in, because I think generally a safety person that compiles, I'll use work at HOTS as the example, compiles a 400-page fall protection plan. They feel great having all this information, but you give that to somebody on site that needs to safely climb a cat ladder, the probability is they're not going to find that one or two pages that really impact them.
Yes.
Meaning, how do I safely climb that? How do I stay connected at all times? And I think it's something that people need to be more aware of.
Exactly. That's true. That's true.
How do you define safety now? Is it any different from before your accident?
It is very different now. Now, what has made it different is not only what I went through, but also the knowledge that I've gained of safety. Remember, I've done my many safety courses, including my NIBOS diplomas and stuff, perspective now of safety.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And you've kind of alluded to it, but I don't think we've actually touched on it. What gives your life meaning now?
What gives my life meaning, I can say, is just the fact that I'm actually doing something for the community. When I say the community, I mean the global community. Because remember, I go around the world preaching the safety gospel. It's safety, safety, safety. So I get fulfillment out of that. So it's really giving my life some meaning. Remember, I was telling you about the fact that everyone has got some music playing in the distance. I got this from Dr. Wayne Dyer. He says, everyone has got some music playing in the distance. All we have to do is to march towards that music. So this is actually figurative. What he's trying to say is that this music is our passion and our purpose. You have to hear that music. You have to see your purpose. You have to see your passion. And what you have to do is to march towards it. This is exactly what I'm doing. You mustn't die with the music still playing. If I had died before this work that I'm doing now, I think I was going to be the most disappointed man. I was going to be a spook.
Tell me, in your music, is that safety? Is that spreading the word, making sure that other people don't experience what you've had to go through?
Exactly. That is my music. Safety and spreading the safety gospel. That I do and everything I do about safety, that is my music. Listen to your music. Yeah. What is your music? It's very fulfilling.
I need to make sure that you know that that music definitely spreads. Like I mentioned, hearing you at the FEM event, Safetember, that hits a chord with somebody who's not directly the person using the PPE, but that is on the same mission. And I think, Partington, it's really been phenomenal to hear your story and experience you in person, and definitely keep making a noise and letting other people hear that music, because I think you're affecting way more people than you might know. And again, where that links with us, we hope that this conversation, if it saves one person, it's done its job. And I think that's very much aligned with what you're trying to achieve.
No, thank you so much, Dylan. I really enjoyed this conversation. And I hope even in future, we are going to have more conversations. And I also hope we are going to spread that music as well, not only on my behalf, but also on your behalf as a safety person.
So
thank you so much.
Thanks, Partington.
Okay.
Cheers. Thank you for joining us, and I hope this episode added value to you. If you are experiencing any safety challenges on your sites and require any additional information, please do leave us a message on LinkedIn via Protector Safety Gear's page, or alternatively follow the link below and share a message with us, because maybe it can create value or valuable conversation for future episodes. Be sure to also follow us on LinkedIn. There will be some valuable information shared from today's discussion.